Okay, welcome everyone. Hope you're enjoying Tech Ed so far, and thank you for coming to this session. This session is runtime, continuous feedback in Agile teams, and today we're going to talk about some new tooling we have in Visual Studio 2012 and Team Foundation Server. And really, it's about, have you ever built software, delivered it to your customer, only for the customer to say, no, that's not what I wanted? Or have you had problems in production that you didn't see during development, and it really takes a long time and it's painful to get those problems fixes back into production? Well, the tooling we're delivering really hits those two problem areas. And with me is Sebastian Holz, Chief Marketing Officer for Preemptive Software, one of our partners, and they have an exciting new solution that integrates with Team Foundation Server. He's going to show that, and I'm going to show our storyboarding tools and feedback tools that are new in Visual Studio 2012. And even though this says, you know, it's for Agile teams, you're going to find this tooling is really useful no matter what methodology you're using. You can use these tools, and they're going to be helpful for you. Okay, if you went to the keynote this morning, you saw this slide, and really what we're talking about is two things. One is the cycle time from getting an idea to then putting that idea through, building the software, and putting it into production. And the other one is the time it takes from seeing an issue into production and then being able to get the solution, the fix back into development and then back into production. So we'll be talking about those two things and really focusing on feedback. And now, intuitively, you'd say, well, gosh, the faster you go, the sloppier you're going to be, and you have to trade off quality for speed. And really, it's a balancing act. But for me, I have personal experience that says it isn't true, that, in fact, if you go faster, you can drive higher quality. And one of the areas that I work on Team Foundation Server. A very important part of us building the product is we use the product to build Visual Studio. And we have big servers with terabytes of source code, millions of work items, literally thousands of build machines built off of these servers. And what we found is actually the more often we update the servers, the easier it is. So with Visual Studio 2005 and 2008 and 2010, we waited till beta to update the server. And so it had been many months since we did the update. And when we finally did, you know, moving those terabytes of data to the new schema was very painful. And we found issues we didn't see in our testing, and which is why we do dogfooding. Now with Visual Studio 2012, we, after a few months of coding, went and updated our server. And then have been doing it again every few months. And the more often we do it, the easier it is, because there's less drift between what's in production and what we're deploying. The other example is with Team Foundation Service. How many of you have an account on TFS Preview? All right, if you don't, you should go check it out. It's very cool, really easy to get going. Go to tfspreview.com, and you can get a Team Foundation Server account right on the internet. And so now we are managing this deployment of TFS. And we went from, we first shipped it a year ago in April, and then we updated it last August for the build conference. And when we did that update, we had, you know, many months of changes. And that was actually a pretty painful update, even though, you know, we had relatively few users on it. And then we did another update in December. And again, many months had gone by. And again, this was a pretty painful update. And what we've done is really we forced ourselves and said, no, we're going to do this every 3 weeks. After every sprint, we're going to take what we have. We're going to push it to production. And by doing that, it's really forced a lot of discipline for us. And now we're able to get stuff out to customers, get their feedback. And we get better and better at the deployment process. And there's less drift between what we have in production and what we're working on. And all the way around, it's led to us delivering a high-quality product on the service. So now, With Visual Studio 2012, if you look at each of these different phases, define, deliver, operate, we are delivering a ton of stuff. And in this talk, we're really focusing on using storyboarding tools to help you define what you want to build. And then using feedback collection and integration. So once you have started to build the product, you can get early feedback and often feedback from your stakeholders to make sure you're on track. And then using preemptive in production to pull back data that's going to help you focus on the right things, root cause issues, and get those fixes back into production. Okay, so what are some of the things that make it hard to deliver the right value? What big problem we see is that the business analyst misunderstands the customer. So you go to the customer, you understand their problem, you come out with a big, 50-page document, say, "Fump, is this what you want?" And the customer's kind of looking at you cross-eyed like, "I'm going to trust you're going to build the right thing, that what we talked about is what you're putting in the specification, but I'm not going to read every jot and tittle." Well, by the time you get done, it's been a long time, deliver the software, and the customer says, "Yeah, no, that's not what we wanted. That's what we had in the document." So how do you effectively communicate to the customer what you're going to build? Storyboarding is a great tool for this. And then another impediment is now you hand the big, thick spec to your dev team, and they go to build it. Well, they misunderstand what they're supposed to be building, and they build the wrong thing. Now, once the wrong thing has been built, it's really expensive to fix it. And the development team's going to be resistant to do that. They're going to try to hack and slash their way to get the right solution, and that's going to build up technical debt. The other problem we see is devs are feature-focused, not customer experience-focused. And as you're going to see, storyboarding is a great tool to make it customer experience-focused, where you're really focused on the end-to-end scenario. And that's been a big emphasis at Microsoft, something we call scenario-focused engineering, where we build up what is the end customer experience going to be, and then we implement that and really focus on the end-to-end scenarios. And you're going to see when I show storyboarding how it's a great tool to enable scenario-focused engineering. All right, and then the last impediment here, I have test environments are not production. And by that I mean, it's working in your test lab during development, then you go to production, and maybe there's configuration problems or environmental problems that you didn't see in the test lab, because there really is one production. So what do you do about that? And that's where we have tooling to help you do root cause analysis and figure out, okay, what's really going on in production, so you can identify the fixes and get them back back into production. Okay, and so with that, I'm going to show you our storyboarding tools. Storyboarding really has its genesis in the movie business. Adam Kogan was telling me about this, and before they build a movie, they'll put up pictures of what each of the scenes are going to be, so they don't go through all the trouble and expense of building a set only to find out they want changes. Well, software is kind of similar, really. So I'm going to show you how storyboarding can help you tell the story you want and help you share it with your customers and your development team. Okay, so I'm going to switch over to a VM here. Now, I'm a product, a business analyst. I'm working on a web team. We are building out this Fabricam Fiber support site. This is where internal people can come and file incidents for issues we're seeing with our fiber service. And we're using Team Foundation Server and Visual Studio 2010 to manage this project. And here in Visual Studio 2010, we've added this notion of a team. And a team lets you define, who are the individuals working on the project. And then we have a team homepage here, which is fully customizable. And here I can see for our current sprint what the burn down looks like, how many hours are remaining. We've chosen to show our build, so build favorites show up on the page. You can see the bars represent success and fail, and the height of the bar shows how long it took. So you can surface a bunch of rich information here. You can see in my product backlog, I currently have 9 items. So what I'm going to do as the business analyst and product owner, I'm going to drill into our product backlog and take a look. And you can see the top thing on our backlog is I want to, the service rep wants to be able to view service ticket details from the dashboard. And so in the past, I might, you know, just turn this over to the dev team, but what I want to do is storyboard it so I can make sure they understand, you know, what we're trying to do here. So I can come to the work item, go to the storyboards tab, and you can see I don't have any storyboards currently, so I'm going to start storyboarding. So this launches into PowerPoint, and this is an important thing here. So what we've chosen to do is integrate storyboarding into PowerPoint. So this is the PowerPoint you know and love. The two things we've added are the storyboarding tab here, which surfaces some custom commands we've built, plus all the things that are handy in PowerPoint for storyboarding. And we've also added the shapes library. And so we've put a bunch of shapes in the box, and you can see you can use this to mock up any kind of application. So for example, if I have a web app, it gives me a quick way to show the browser. Or if I'm building a phone app, I could put that on there. And now I can, you know, create my mock-ups pretty quickly. And you can see different types of apps are supported. And you can add your own style of app in here. Let's say if you're working on an iPhone app or whatever, you could add those in. And so, but I'm working on this website, and I've already done some mock-ups for it. I don't want to start from scratch. So what I did was created a slide master, and this is for anybody doing mock-ups on our website, and so this will give you a quick way to get started. And so here, what I'm going to do is go ahead and copy this out. Paste it into here and keep my slide master. So now what this does for me is you can see this is now baked into the layout. So whatever slide I put up is going to have this as a background. And this is really nice because as I make changes, I can change them in one place. It's going to change for all my storyboards. The other thing is I am working on this site. Let me pull this up. And so instead of starting from scratch, I want to start from content I already have. So so what I'm going to do is start with a screenshot. So here I can put different things on my page. You know, we've got the shapes here. I can use the shapes from PowerPoint. First thing I'll do is use a screen clipping. Scrape out some of this content. And we have shapes for different types of controls. The search makes it really easy to find them. So I'm going to drop a button on here. And since it's PowerPoint, it's really easy to create the effects you need. And I'll make that bold so you can see how easy this is. And so if you go back to my user story, this was about, let me see, I want to be able to view the service ticket details from the dashboard. Okay, so the idea is that I can go and click on one of these links and it's going to open it. So I'll go ahead and create another slide. And so on this slide, now I click on a link, so I want to show the details. And so I'm going to go ahead and insert a text box. if I could type. So you can see, so I'm in PowerPoint, so I can use text styling, and you can see it'd be pretty quick and easy for me to mock up what the details would look like. And maybe this has some geo information, so I'm going to drop a map on here so I can show where this customer is. And do a quick mock-up this way. The other thing is, I think I'm going to use these incident details in other places in my mock-ups. So rather than having to recreate this every time, what I can do is add this to my shapes. And now, pasted more of these. Now, anytime I want to use it, I can just grab it out of here, and I meant to rename it. All right, so it's really easy for me to create new shapes, save them off, and I can quickly reuse them. Now, anybody who gets this PowerPoint, it's all just PowerPoint content, so it's all gonna work seamlessly for them. Now, if I wanted to share this with my team, what I could do is export my shapes and then give them over to my teammates, and then they could import them. Or similarly, I can import shapes from my teammates and, you know, share them on SharePoint or wherever. But you can see this is a really quick and easy way to get your storyboards put together. The other thing is it is PowerPoint, so one thing I want to do is show exactly what the customer is doing. So an easy way to do that is to put a mouse pointer on the screen and simulate the user actually clicking on one of the items. And I'm going to use animation to do that. PowerPoint's super easy to do animation. I just take this. I can say, customer is clicking on this one. All right. Now when I go to present this, a nice thing is I don't have, you know, a separate presentation to do versus my document. I can just F5 this, show the user clicking, and drill it into the incident. All right. So you can see it's pretty quick and easy. So now what I'm going to do is save this off. And I'm going to share it back up on SharePoint and say, okay, now it asks me, do you want to link this storyboard to your TFS work item? So I'll say yes. And now what this is doing is, if I go back to TFS, and refresh this work item. Now you can see this, my storyboard's associated with the work item. So when the developer comes to work on this user story, the storyboard's there. They can open it and see, yes, this is what the customer experience is intended to be. All right, so that's storyboarding. And you can see it really enables you to have rich communication with your stakeholders. And it's your customers, if you're working on commercial software, whoever your stakeholders are, it really paints a picture of what you're going to build. And I was talking to Adam Kogan, who said he makes his customer, he prints them out, makes them initial every slide. So then they have to go through it, and it's a pretty lightweight thing to do. It leads to a scenario focus, and it's really lightweight way to iterate designs. One thing you can do with PowerPoint, it's really easy to say, if the user clicks on this button, go to the create new screen. If the user clicks on a link, go to this other screen. And so that gives you a really quick way to actually do prototypes in PowerPoint. And so you can take that to your customer, have them interact with the PowerPoint actually, and get their feedback before you build it. And once you deliver this to the development team, it's very clear to them what the customer experience and expectations are. Okay, so that's PowerPoint storyboarding. The next thing I want to talk about is getting feedback from your customer. So now you've handed the PowerPoint off to your dev team. They're going off, they're building. Let's say you're working in Agile, using Agile, so you're iterating. As you iterate, you want to make sure you're building the right software. So the idea of the feedback tool is it gives you a way to bring the software to your customer, get their feedback straight from the customer, and then make sure you're on the right track. So I'm going to go to a demo of our feedback tool. Okay, so I am the product owner, and as my development team, we've gone through, we built one iteration of what we think the customer wants. So what I'm going to do is request feedback. And so here, the idea is I'm going to request feedback from certain stakeholders. And I can enter a list of names here. And let me go ahead and do that. So I'm going to request feedback from Adam. You can request feedback. There's different styles of applications. In this case, it is our website, so this makes it pretty easy. So I can come in here and type in the URL. If I wanted to, I could give them a link to a virtual machine, if it's, say, a Windows 8 app, or actually give them a path to download a client app. So I'm going to tell them to go ahead and click on the link to load the app. And then I want to get feedback on viewing incident details from the home page. Maybe so Adam, he had the idea, so I'm saying, hey, you asked for this, what do you think? And what this is going to result in is an email to Adam. It's going to copy me, and I can preview the email here, and it's pretty simple. The email has a link to start the session. It does require a feedback tool, so the customer, your stakeholder, has to install this tool. It's a very lightweight install, it installs very quickly, and I can also customize this email if I want to put more, change it, whatever. So I'm going to go ahead and hit send. So now Adam's going to get this email. And now I'm going to switch over to Adam. He's the one who asked for this feature. I'm going to switch over to his VM. All right. And is this the right one? Let me see. Hold on a second. Did I hit send? Yes. Okay. So I'm cheating a little bit because, there it is. Okay, so I don't have an email server set up on my demo environment. And actually, I'm glad I didn't rely on Hotmail or something like that because I'd be kind of toast right now, but, since the internet is down. So what I'm doing is I'm showing you the drop spot actually on the server. So I'm Adam. I got this email. I load it up. And here I'm going to go ahead and start my feedback session. Okay, so it says to click on the link. I do that. Okay, now go to the next tab. And okay, so view incident details from the homepage. We implemented this. What do you think? all right, well, this is cool. So what I can do here, so you can see the feedback client is loaded on the left. And the reason this is nice is that it makes it really easy for me as a stakeholder to give different kinds of feedback. I can start a recording, actually, record all my actions and a voice recorder so I can talk to what I'm doing, which is really a really nice way to give feedback because it's very fast to give the feedback. I can easily take screenshots or just do a voice recording or only a screen recording. So here I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to drill into one of these. Hey, that's pretty cool. Well, one thing is, I like it, and I can use bold and whatnot to format my text. One thing I don't like is, gosh, I wish I could see more of the ticket. So I'm going to say, take a screenshot and say, yeah, I don't like all the wasted space at the top. Can we tighten that up? Okay. So then I'm going to go ahead and do a recording of my screen, and I'm going to record assigning a new this ticket to an engineer. Okay. Well, this is pretty cool because I can see which engineers have availability. So I'm going to sit stop and say, all right, so you can get a pretty good feel for it's really easy for me to create these screenshots and give rich feedback. So I'm going to go ahead and say, yeah, overall, I'm going to submit my feedback. I think it's pretty good. Submit and close. Okay, so now I'm done. This gives me a way to see, yeah, these guys seem like they're on track right now. Or if they weren't on track, to course correct. Okay, so now I'm going to switch back over to the product owner. And one of the things on our homepage is a feedback tile. So if I hit refresh here, you can see I've got new feedback. So I'm going to go ahead and look, and here's the feedback from Adam that I requested. Okay, so I can drill into that. And now you can see the feedback that Adam requested. Seemed like a lot of wasted space here. Boy, yeah, I see what he means. And he likes the experience. Okay, so what I'm going to do is say, yeah, let's tighten this up. So I'm going to go ahead and create a new user story to tighten the vertical space at the top. All right, now this user story is linked back to the feedback. And so we can track it back to the feedback and keep accountability for acting on the feedback. And then once this is implemented, I can go back and close the feedback item and then kind of close the loop. Okay, so this shows you how easy it is to request feedback as a stakeholder, give rich feedback back on software that's the working software that's in progress. And then for me as the product owner, then to take that feedback and drive requirements back into the product. Okay. And yeah, so you can see within a sprint we can iterate, and then also if the tool's in production, if you're cycling fast, you can get feedback straight from the customer that's using your application in production. Okay, now the last topic we want to talk about is leveraging operations to improve your software. And in Visual Studio 2012, we've got several things that tools that will help with this. So one, you can now use IntelliTrace in production. And there's more talks on IntelliTrace in production. I'm going to give up a list of talks at the end that are related. And we also have integration with System Center. You can find a talk on that at TechEd this week. And then Sebastian is going to talk about preemptive and how preemptive analytics helps you leverage operations to build better software. And the key thing is it's not just operations, but it really does drive improvements back into your software. And the other thing, it helps you focus on the right things when you're building a product. One thing we found is we get SQIM data back from our Dr. Watson data back from our customers. So if we get crashes, we get crash counts. And we find that 20% of the errors cause 80% of the user issues. So it's really important to focus on the right errors. And so the most common, most occurring errors first. And this is where the preemptive tool really comes in and can help you with that.
Okay.
And this Sebastian's going to talk about that.
Thank you, Ed. Hello, everybody. Good afternoon. Now, in all deference to the thousands of pretend employees at Fabricam, when we're going to talk about actually getting feedback from the wild, from production, driving development priorities, refining user experience, we find it's better to focus on actual production data as a teaching tool. The downside of using production data is we did count on the fact that the internet would be available at least enough so that some of you could download this production app, throw exceptions in the audience, and feed them back, and I could show them to you inside TFS in real time. The good news is I took a couple screenshots this morning during the keynote, and I do have TFS, of course, running locally. So I'm going to step you through real-life data, thousands of users' activity. But for those of you, did anybody actually download this app in advance of the session? Yeah, I always get people to do it right before, but the Wi-Fi was down. Anyway, so we are going to focus on real-world data, and I do want to sort of tie this back again to this cycle, this iteration, development life cycle, and where exactly this technology fits in. So let me first say preemptive analytics is now a part of Visual Studio 2012 and TFS. So for those of you that have downloaded the RC edition, has anyone downloaded the 2012 RC? Okay, so there's nothing more for you to do. You can just configure this with literally a few clicks. If you take the default settings, everything I'm going to show you around preemptive analytics for TFS is available to you today, right now. What it does is it really touches this cycle in three critical places. First, instrumentation. So the first thing you're going to need to do is light up your application. Okay, you're going to need to, and what happens is we can consume preemptive analytics via Dofuscator. Have any of you ever heard of Dofuscator? It's been in Visual Studio for a while. A lot of nodding heads. So many of you probably think of Dofuscator as an obfuscation tool, a tool that makes it harder to reverse engineer. Still does that. That's not what this talk is about. It's not required. Okay, Dofuscator has a new function that can be used together or apart from that traditional role. So what we're talking about now is taking Dofuscator, I'm going to show you this, pointing it at an existing assembly, okay? And then you're going to identify what you want to know about this application after it's been deployed. Okay, and if you want to harden it, and you see that's the second point, that's available to you, not required. But the critical piece is that once it's deployed, And to be clear, there's zero additional installation required, and it will go wherever your software goes. So if you're deploying into Azure and you want data to stream out of Azure, if you're deploying to a phone and you want the data to come off of the phone, WPF, SQL CLR, server side, ASP.NET, anywhere your code is going, including even Java. So if you've downloaded the RC, there's a link you can follow, and we'll give you a Java API, and you can instrument your Java code, again, Android or whatever, and stream that data, that exception data, to the same TFS endpoint and automatically create work items. So feedback is critical. You know, why do you want to do this? Well, again, you want to clarify the requirements. You want to know what's important, not based on what you think or what you've heard, but actually based on what people are doing. You want to support the priorities that you're setting. Again, to Ed's very important point, that 20% of exceptions typically cause 80% of the heartache. So how do you identify those 20? There's an English saying, the squeaky wheel gets the oil, right? The loudest complaining users get all the attention. That's not necessarily the right approach, right? Really, what you want is to address the majority, or at least the material users, right? The ones that have the highest impact. This allows you to do that. Validating test plans. Again, this is not displacing any of your existing tools. Unit testing, scenario-based testing, regression testing, of course, critically important. But if you're feeling good that you have 95% code coverage, well, you might not feel as good if that 5 or 10% that you're not testing is being used 40% of the time in the field, right? So it's a data point, okay, that allows you, it's another spoke in the wheel of both your development, your testing, and in fact, your operational wheel, okay? So I'm going to step you through very quickly the different components, and then we're going to drop back and look at some real software. So I mentioned instrumentation. Again, for .NET, inside the box, we can inject the instrumentation post-compile. There's an API. And then there are a commercial alternative that you can get from Preemptive that's not in the box that includes an API for native, C++, for JavaScript, and as I said already, for Java as well. So pretty much any software that you're building, wherever you're sending it, you can keep your fingers on that pulse, as we say. So wherever it's going. Now, where is that data going to go? Right, you've lit up your app. It's now able to send stuff back to you. Well, what does that mean? Well, in the box, in Visual Studio 2012 and TFS, and let me be very clear, it's in every SKU other than Express. So it does not count with Express. But other than Express, everything I'm talking about with you is included. You do need TFS for the repository. So we provide to you a web service that will listen for these events. And that URI, the URI that you are given when you configure this, is one of the things you inject into your app. And again, I'm going to show you this, okay? So you tell it where to send the data. And that endpoint could sit on the same server as your TFS instance. It could sit in a separate server. You could put it up in Azure. You could host it yourself somewhere else. Why? Because there's yet another service that has rules and listens and watches that endpoint. And that's where you separate the noise from the material events. So I'm going to show you how you can say, you know what, I don't want a work item inside TFS every time I throw an exception in my app because a file wasn't found or the internet is down, right? Can you imagine all of the exception reports we're going to get today from the apps that depended on internet access, right? You want to be able to have the way to identify common exceptions, and that's automatically built in. So there's a signature that we can calculate, and we'll say, and I'll show you this, you've just got 1,000 instances of this one type of exception from 200 people. And then you can set a rule that says, you know what, if it's 100 people, I don't care. Or if it's 1,000 exceptions, in an hour, I don't care. But if it's 10,000, you know, or 500 people, well, now I care. And so that filter will assure that only material events, production incidents, are surfaced inside TFS, and it will automatically create a work item that you, first class work item, that you can then assign, manage, and ultimately resolve. Okay, so that's the, and that's where I'm going to demonstrate. That's where I'm going to spend my time demonstrating software. I do want to point out that this is really a distinct concept or a next step in application analytics. Typically, analytics are of the first type, which I'm going to show you some screenshots of. Again, internet is down. Typical analytics is you ask lots and lots of questions, and even when you get answers to those questions, you're not sure exactly what you're going to do about it, right? So, for example, if I'm wondering, do I want to deprecate a feature? Well, I might say, well, you know, how many people are using it? Now, if I see 100 people are using this feature, does that mean automatically I don't have to have a discussion with a product owner or users? For sure, I'm killing this feature? Well, of course not, right? You're going to talk about who are the users, why are they using it? You know, there's a discussion. So even if you get great information, classic analytics does not automatically result in an action. However, in the example that Ed gave, where you're doing high-speed continuous releases of your product, and all of a sudden you get, you know, 5,000 file not founds in an hour, well, chances are there's probably an error in the, you know, the manifest that you've just distributed, because that's atypical, and you know immediately there isn't. I don't want to hope that somebody is watching the screen waiting for a line to cross another line, or that person is authorized or sort of, you know, educated enough to know they must respond immediately. That's the kind of rule I want to bake in. I want automatic, timely, intelligent response. So I'm going to show you both of those, how you can quickly do the kind of discovery that leads to more intelligent discussions and decisions. And last, but certainly not least, how you can automate response for those critical events where you know your organization wants to respond. Okay, so this is the sprint, and again, no internet access, so the one downside for the discovery on a portal is that you need to be able to get to that portal. I actually took these, and you can see from the criterion, you know, I took these this morning as during the keynote, so they are actually pretty relevant. And these, and if you want to see this live in action, I guess you could stop by. Preemptive has a booth, 32. Stop by, see it. We'll show it to you live. But here's some quick screenshots. So this is the app that I was going to ask you to download. It's a yoga app. It's got about 70,000 users, so it's a real-world app. I built it because I wanted to have data to show audiences like you. And unlike, say, a Google Analytics that owns your data and can do whatever they want, we don't. So I needed to own my own data that I could share. So this is real data, and I can show you, you know, runs, unique users, how much time they're spending. You know, that's fine. You see here that we've got both Android and .NET. So, you know, the feature like view a pose in yoga, the fact that the code is totally different under the covers on Android versus Windows Phone, as a product owner, I don't care. I want to know how many people are taking a particular action. So I can, this is not a code tracing software. This is functional, operational application impact monitoring. So I can see operating systems, I can see, you know, all of that. And I did it this morning, and happily, there's a whole bunch of people here locally using the app, so we can do geolocation. Again, I know how important privacy is everywhere, and particularly in the EU. This is actually done by looking at the connecting tower, so there's no personally identifiable information collected to do something like that. I can look at feature usage. Okay, that's great. But, you know, knowing that somebody viewed a pose in a yoga app is not that interesting. Why else would you go into an app, right? That's like saying, you know, somebody created a, you know, a work item or a customer identity in the app that Ed just showed, right? Well, if there's a problem with it and it's data driven, right, knowing that they created a user, well, that's all they do in that app. I want to actually see the data behind that customer record, for example. So you can do that too. You can grab custom data. And here I can actually see the poses that are most popular, right? So who would have known that the Earth Mudra would be more popular than the revolving triangle? I'll be honest, I don't even know what that means. My wife is the domain expert in yoga, but apparently that's very important. But you know, being a little less, and that's real data, but maybe making it more universal, I can track custom data, not only when users take actions in my app, but also when unique actions or events occur also within my app. So this is showing whenever there's an exception, I would like to grab the custom data, what was the culture setting of the app. So this is just a very simple example of when something is occurring in my app that I really care about, I want to grab additional information that's not obviously, that's not necessarily going to be a part of a stack trace or something else. And keep your mind on this, that actually turns out to be important in a later story. And then lastly, of course, I can look at exceptions. And I like to show this to these audiences like this because if you'll notice, the volume of exceptions is so high on Android that the Windows Phone exceptions can't even make the top like chart like they're drowned out. So, you know, the data speaks for itself. So anyway, but you can do that. But again, what does this lead up to? This still, the point is, I look at this. This doesn't necessarily tell my development team what to do. Right? This is great if I'm a product owner. There's a lot of really interesting scenarios. I want to focus on actionable intelligence. So very quickly, even just with that type of analysis, I'll give you some very real world scenarios. I was able to show, and I have a blog on this that where I go into detail and all this, but you know, for anybody here have mobile apps that they've either built or are thinking of building? Just tell me how fast to go. None. Okay, well, I'll go very fast then. Okay, what I wanted to do is track, in this case, conversion rates of people who had used my trial versus a free app that gave an upgrade path. And what I found was the free app completely cannibalized my trials, but the overall conversion increased by 85%. Okay, so this tied specific cross-platform behaviors directly to a monetizing event. Right now, if you look at the app, I also do true A/B testing. Right, I know that my users like yoga, and I know they're thinking about yoga because they're in my app. So I throw up different types of fake ads, if you will, and then measure the click-through rates on my fake ads, as well as the ads that are served in a context-central way, right, from both AdCenter and AdMob on Google. And I can now contrast how well their ad servers are doing, and I can also look at my users' preferences. And this, again, nobody here building mobile apps, but this actually speaks a lot to helping you decide should your app be ad-driven or not. It's another story. The last one, though, I think is a universal one, and it also has a European story to it. I was getting an illegal operation error in my Windows Phone app, and I could not figure it out. Okay, and again, I was just thinking how ironic it is, because if you don't know, Ed is very, very technical, and he just spent the first half of this presentation, well, not all of it, but a lot of it in PowerPoint. And I'm a chief marketing officer, and I'm about to take you through a tour of instrumenting IL, okay? So how, you know, you really see how the tools are integrating and all the different ways of communicating and working are coming together. But I was getting these stack traces, and I couldn't figure it out, okay? So I grabbed some custom data, and I showed you that earlier, right? I showed you how I could get the localization and the location. And it turned out that just counting, you know, the number of exceptions, of these exceptions, didn't really help because I have so many more users in the US and English-speaking locations in general than other language. Just counting them didn't really tell me anything. But comparing them, the data set that had exceptions to the data set that didn't have exceptions, this is a key point. Usually when you're doing debugging, you get a whole bunch of exception data, right? And they may have 1,000 literally 1,000 features or characteristics in common. And how do you whittle down which ones are material and which ones are coincidental? Well, when you can compare it to a healthy body of data, well, clearly anything that's shared across all of those users is irrelevant, right? So I was able to eliminate what features they were using, what device phone they were on. I was the operating system version, firmware, all that stuff. It turned out when I did a ratio of healthy sessions to exceptions, Germans were 14 times more likely to have this exception than any other, followed closely by Austria, the Netherlands, Malaysia, and Mexico. And I can only theorize why, but when I really looked at it, it turns out to maybe have something to do with how impatient the user is. Because what it was is, if I was playing a video or showing a long list of poses with images, you know, I'm not a very good developer. So it took, you know, a second or two for that data to render. And if you said, show it to me, come on, I'm waiting, the app got confused. And it didn't know exactly where in the stack my instructions were executing. And it thought I was trying to write to the screen when I didn't have authority. It was an invalid operation. So what I learned, well, one, it helped me. I needed that healthy data and the exception data to figure that out. But what I also learned is if this culture, if any culture, is important to me, they have to be in my beta community, right? It's not enough to have a novice user and an expert user, right? People, as you all know, in a sort of a heterogeneous group like this, different cultures approach everything uniquely, not just their food and their clothing and their music. And so they use applications differently. And as such, some edge case errors in some cultures will be front and center and absolutely unavoidable in others. So that was kind of a universal one. Okay, so, but let's move on to actual real software. So I'm going to show you how I instrumented that app. I'm going to show you how to connect that to TFS, and I'm going to show you how to surface those exceptions intelligently inside TFS. So let me exit that. First, I'm going to instrument. So this is, I'm inside DoffuSkater, and again, you're going to have DoffuSkater inside Visual Studio 2012. And the only thing you're going to want to do with regard to the defaults is you're going to override one thing, which is send analytics messages. Okay, and in my case, I also turned off renaming. You don't have to, but I chose to because you don't have to do any protection. Skip over all that, and I'm going to jump to, oh, you point to your input. Let's not forget about that. In my case, I'm pointing at a zap file. Okay, and I jump to instrumentation, and there's really only five little attributes I need to set. The first is I identify my organization. And if you're using preemptive analytics for TFS, you're going to make up your own key because it's your organization and it's your endpoint. If you were using our commercial service, we would give you this key. Okay? This just identifies, it's just part of the way that we prevent other people from sending you data. Okay? You can give it a name, not required. And let me just show you, it's very easy to add these things. You just say, I want to add an attribute, and it's context aware, and it just shows you the attributes that can be added at any given point in time. And so the business one, that's number one. I need to identify the application. If you leave this blank, we'll pull it from the project inside Visual Studio. We'll generate one for you if you like. And it's a good idea to persist this across multiple versions of your app if you want to be able to both roll up version counts as well as break them down. Okay? Give it a name, nice idea, not required, version number. Okay? So we're almost done. You're going to add an exception. And inside preemptive analytics for TFS, you can only grab unhandled. In the commercial version, you can also do handle, caught, and thrown. But again, I'm going to just focus on what you could do today with RC. I can also grab custom data at any point. I can point at a property, a method, and grab its return value. I can also point to a privacy policy URI, okay, and have they opted in. Okay, so you can set, you can tell DoffuSkater, I want to check, has the user opted in. And you can set that property, you can open up a UI, you can have it be a web service call. And we actually, there's actually two levels of opt-in that you can check. One is when exceptions occur, and one is just generic usage. Okay, so we don't create that opt-in policy. You will do that. We just enforce it once you've set it. So this is, again, one of the major differences in our approach to analytics versus almost any other type of monitoring. We assume you're going to deploy outside of your organization. We assume it may be to consumers or to partners, and that the rules of engagement may change jurisdiction by jurisdiction. And so we allow you to set your own policies, and we will enforce them for you. And when it's opted out, this doesn't even start up. Okay, and again, there's no agents. This runs in a lower priority thread inside your process. Okay, so we're almost done. Those are, you know, that takes a couple minutes. Then you have to identify your input and your entry and your exit points in your app. Just very quickly, for phones, it turns out there's two, right? There's the launch, and then there's the activated. You point it where you want it to go. So I'm pointing it to our commercial service. If we had internet access, this would be very cool because you would throw the exception and I'd show it to you in real time. You will point to your URI that you are given when you configure this, okay? There's a variety of things. In the commercial version, for example, you can encrypt all the data on the wire, and there's also offline caching. So if the network is down for whatever reason, it writes it to isolated storage and sends that data up at a later time. Particularly important on Silverlight and the phone, where you have no clear end of life inside the application. You always write it typically to isolated storage and then send it up the next time the app is started. That happens automatically. There's no programming to be done. And then I have just a shutdown, similar thing. That's four, right? And then the fifth thing, similarly, is teardown. And I take all the defaults. That just says, hey, when we're shutting down, close down the thread, be nice and orderly. And when I'm done with that, I just hit build. And what it's doing is it's taking in my zap file, following these instructions, which are, by the way, stored in an XML file separately. So you save that. In the commercial version, you can then feed that in to an MS build task or a command line, and you're able to make it part of a continuous release process. So it's done. It's writing the assemblies. I just want to show you the log. There we go. So it's telling me what it's doing. You know, it did feature. I had some feature tracking. Again, I'm going to skip over that just in the interest of time. Similarly, you right-click on a method. It could be as fine-grained as a method. You can say how long. You can ask to be told how long you spend inside a method or just how many times a particular method, you know, feature are used. So I'm done. Now I would deploy this like I would deploy anything else. So if it's, you know, wherever it's going, it just goes. No additional artifacts, no files, no nothing. So now let's jump back into 2012, okay? And the only thing you have to do, say, well, great, but now I've got the data, it's going to some endpoint, what now? Well, the only other thing you need to do is define your rules, okay? Because, again, you don't want all of this data just to show up inside TFS. So the first thing you do is you define what we call an exception set. And it's basically different buckets of different types of exceptions. So you might have authentication exceptions. You might have web communication ones, you know, or just generic exception handling. In this case, I'm saying give me them all, right? It's these exception sets that your rules will focus on. And I create a rule by, if you remember those two strings I needed at the beginning, right? My business ID and the application ID. This tells me that this rule is focused on that particular application. Okay? And it's a very simple rule. Right? And by the way, if I was in the in the admin menu, I'd be able to pick which server in the project, you know, all of the authorization and access rules are enforced. You know, this particular role, all I can do is identify the area path, and I'm going to give it a name, and I'm going to have a very low threshold. Again, if I was going to be doing live processing, I wanted it to show up every single, you know, right away. So I say threshold of one exception from, you know, the all exceptions bucket. Create the work item called incident, which, by the way, is included, you know, inside PA, inside TFS. So that's it. I'm done. And from the homepage, there's a preemptive analytics hub. And when I select that, I can then take a look at all the work items that are created. And luckily, I did create a few this morning because I'm always paranoid. And it's showing me, right, that I had 49 raw exceptions from 7 different computers, right? I can look at incident details, which, by the way, there are also custom data. Like, I want to actually have the user give me feedback. So in addition to the stack trace and any system information, I have the ability for them to provide contact information and a comment. So not only will I get the stack trace and all that telemetry, they might say, gee, I was in the middle of doing X, Y, Z, and I hit this button, and if you want to ask me more questions, contact me here. Right? So all of that is passed through. And if you'll notice, it's a, you know, first class work item, so I can make it active or closed. I can assign it, of course. And if I look down, for example, it's saying accept new data. So this is actually a live work item. So even as exceptions are coming in and I've assigned this, they're going to continue to get additional data, not new work items. Right? It's identifying that it's the same type of exception. Okay, I can't override that, of course. And also, by default, if I close the work item, it will no longer accept data. But I can, again, override that, you know, because maybe I do want to get it because I think I shouldn't get any more. So if I do, you know, I'd like to know. So there's a lot of flexibility in terms of who gets it, who sees it, right, and what type of data is collected. And again, now you're off and running, right? You now have identified, you've crossed the material threshold. I want to act on it. It's assigned to the right group. And then there's just these are very sort of rudimentary charts that also follow. So I can look at the number of work items created over time. So again, even though I had lots of exceptions, only one work item, because it identified it as being part of the same rule. And I can also look at the status of those as well, right? So just to sort of close the whole loop, right, we've shown how you can instrument any app, send data wherever you want it to go, define rules that make sense for your business. So your, you know, operations, they want to know about every single problem, right? And they'll just, you know, and they may need to respond, right? But development teams, they're, you know, you're working within a sprint. You don't want your developers interrupted by noise. So you can set that gain, that threshold with these rules. When those thresholds are crossed, the right information is delivered to the right people. Again, driving better decision-making, higher quality, greater responsiveness, lower technical debt. So with that, well, I guess we're going to open it up, I guess, in general, but any immediate questions on just this, what I just shown you? Yes, sir.
Does this work in TFS preview?
Question was, does it work in TFS preview? It can, it is not part of the deployment. So the endpoint and the rules engine that I just showed you is not part of that. However, the aggregator that I showed you can point at any TFS server. It does not have to be local. All right, well, there'll be more time for questions. Ed?
Oh. Okay, thank you, Sebastian. Okay, so to wrap up, we showed you today our storyboarding tools, the feedback tool, and some new tools for operations that can help you get feedback throughout the development cycle, before you start, once you started, once you put it into operations, and really help you close the loop and iterate faster and build better software. I want to call out some related content. So we've got a bunch of talks on that whole set of tools I just listed. And you can download our deck to get this list of talks that are happening throughout the week. There's actually 3 slides of this. It's a lot of stuff.
All good.
All good. And the other thing is the hands-on lab. I was actually demoing from a demo VM you can download. And we have it in our hands-on labs here. So if you want to get your hands on the software, it's really easy to go do. You can try it out yourself.
Can I just mention that there is an extensive hands-on lab on preemptive analytics for TFS in that corpus as well. So I don't know if that's in there, but
I'm sure it is. All right. And I want to call out the Visual Studio homepage, Soma's blog, Jason Zander's blog, and my manager's Brian Harry's blog. He always puts out a lot of great stuff. And you can Facebook and Twitter us as well. And here's more resources for you regarding the event this week. And then finally, please submit an eval. If you take time to do that, that'll help us get better. So next time, we'll give you an even better talk. Pardon?
So I can go back to the blog slide.
Okay, and now we're going to open it up for questions. If you have any more questions.
The instrumenting, how does it work with ASP.NET or MPC applications?
So the question for the recording, the question is, how does it work with ASP.NET and MVC? So it works fine. What you need to do, obviously, the entry and exit point of the application tends to be more of a beginning and end of a session rather than the actual application start. But other than the slight different design approach, it works just fine.
Yep.
How does this impact performance?
Right, so the question is how does the instrumentation impact performance? To give my CTO's response is, it depends, which I know is very unsatisfying. So let me add a little bit more clarity, although now maybe a little less accuracy. It is designed to be very, very stealthy, okay? So it is currently inside a lot of Windows Phone games, for example, just to give you a metric that, a small device, highly performant, it runs in a lower priority thread. It caches. It fires and forgets. It writes to isolated storage. When things get very bad, it will actually throw away messages rather than impede or impact performance. So if there's any type of I.O., the general guidance that we often give is if there's any type of I.O., either to a user through presentation or to some sort of device, the impact will be negligible. Okay, I would not use it inside a tightly nested loop in a physics engine or a simulator or a trading module. There is something, but it is designed to not impact performance.
You said you have to configure it with the station tool that is integrated. Do you have to always manually start the process to get it into your assembly, or can you do that with the automated builds as well?
Right. So the question is, how automated can the instrumentation be? So there's the initial instrumentation has to be done manually. And the reason for that is it's not a broad profiler that collects all data. The analogy I often make is profiling is typically like sculpting, where you get everything. And then afterwards, you chip away to find what's meaningful. Whereas this is more like painting, where even if you turn it on, we send you nothing. You get a blank canvas. And then you decide during the development process, I only care about this one feature or if the following type of exception occurs. So one way we, again, address the performance issue, by the way, is we just don't do anything unless the development team thinks they want something. Okay, that's the first step. And however, once you've done it once in the commercial SKU, you get an artifact which can then be made part of a regular build process, an automated build process. So if you're signing it, you do a delayed signing, we'll sign it afterwards, and it's just, you know, all the dependencies are resolved, and, you know, it's a full-blown or, you know, native task at that point. So the MS build and a command line, and for Java Ant integration, you know, same thing. So it is designed to be part of a continuous build process. The initial configuration still requires, you know, if you will, an artist to decide exactly what it is that you want.
Other questions? Yep.
Is the storyboarding tool, is that also available outside of Visual Studio TFS or PowerPoint?
Yeah, the question is storyboarding available outside of TFS? That's a good question. So we consider the test professional SKU as, if you're a business analyst, that's the SKU you want. You don't necessarily want a Visual Studio SKU. So that's what we tell you. If you want storyboarding without Visual Studio, get test professional, and storyboarding is available in that SKU. As well as it's in on the Visual Studio side, it's in Premium and Ultimate and Test Pro. That's a good question. Yes?
Same with the feedback tool. Which edition is that integrated?
So the feedback tool, so to give feedback, you just need a limited license. If you're familiar with TFS, we have a work item only view, which is a free license. So it's the requirement is the user has to be configured in TFS, but then there's no license required to give feedback. Request feedback is just part of TFS. So any TFS SKU. I hope I got that right. I'll have to double check that, but I'm pretty sure that's correct. Question? To give feedback without what? Oh, great question. So if you're a stakeholder and you just want to give feedback, yeah, you can start up the feedback tool and send feedback back. And then on the TFS side, somebody has to be looking for that feedback and then routing it to the right teams. Okay? That's a good question. Other questions? Yeah, is feedback available in TFS Preview? Yes, it is. Any other questions? These are all good questions.
60 more seconds.
I noticed that on the analytics package, the version that ships in Visual Studio doesn't use SSL.
That's right.
What's the security like? Are we like getting all our TFS servers hacked?
Right. So the question is, the observation was, first, that SSL encoding from the instrumentation side is not available in the community edition, in the free version. It's really of Dofuscator. It really has nothing to do with TFS, per se. And that is correct. So SSL comes with a commercial SKU. Are you likely to get it hacked? Well, it is the barrier is certainly lowered. So if somebody's listening on a wire, they're going to see SOAP signals going across. The question then is, what are you sending? And the Community Edition is not designed to be a production instrumentation platform for, you know, corporations. It's designed to allow developers to quickly get something up and running to prove the value and to monitor their work, right? If security and scalability is an issue, I would encourage you to look at alternate solutions, commercial solutions.
at your commercial.
And we have a right. I'm trying to be as a I have a marketing in my title, so I'm trying to avoid any appearance of being too salesy. Obviously, the commercial is designed to do that. That could be. So there's two pieces. There's the TFS rules engine and integration piece that has a community and commercial SKU, a variety of features. Again, come by booth 32 for that difference. Separate is the instrumentation piece. If you want SSL, you probably need the commercial one. The internal one would probably be fine. There's some other limitations that may or may not be relevant. I guess the thing I would just say is the Community Edition version is designed not to have a weakness like a last mile problem. If you want to track unhandled exceptions in an application that's being broadly distributed, that is not mission critical or highly secure, this is a complete solution. You don't need any commercial products or upgrades. If you start to go in outside of that use case, you may have additional requirements.
Okay, we are out of time. I thank you for coming. I'll be hanging out at the ALM booth all week, so you want to come talk to me there. Sebastian will be at the preemptive booth.
And also the ALM booth, both, yeah.
And thank you for coming.
Thank you.